Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. David Rhodes was a promising young light in the literary world of the 1970s. Still in his 20s, he had three novels published and a bright future. Then in 1977, in rural Wisconsin, a motorcycle accident left him paralyzed from the waist down. He stopped publishing for more than 30 years, but he never stopped writing. Now he's out with a beautifully written new novel, Driftless, about those same Wisconsin backroads, his home. This hour, On Point, a remarkable story in life and fiction. David Rhodes on second chances and on the quiet, wrenching dramas of rural life in the Midwest. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine coming back after more than three decades of silence and some hard times with a masterpiece? Joining me now from Madison, Wisconsin, is novelist David Rhodes. His early books included The Last Fair Deal Going Down, The Easter Home, and Rock Island Line. His new novel is Driftless. David Rhodes, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's really good to be with you.
It's great to have you. I have to compliment you right off the bat. I just loved this book, and I'm so glad you came out of your, out of your rural life there to share it with us. Thank you very much for coming back to the world as we know it, David.
Well, thank you for those kind comments. I hope writing a masterpiece doesn't make you an old master, but I'm just thrilled to be with you today. Let's talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Well, let's first of all talk about the terrain of this novel, which in many ways has been the terrain of your life. You set it in a fictional town, Wards, Wisconsin, W-O-R-D-S, Wards, Wisconsin, in the southwest of the state, and your very title, Driftless, comes from the terrain of this region. Can you explain it to us, David?
Sure. There's a region in southwest Wisconsin. Actually, it's also extends into part of Minnesota and a little bit of Iowa. But what it describes is during the last ice age, which ended about 10,000 years ago, the glaciers, which moved south, were, of course, clearing out the hills and leveling the ground, and they missed this particular area, and they went around it. And so in going around it, the geologists in later years looked at what was in the soil, and when a glacier moves through an area, not only does it level off the land, but it leaves deposits of minerals and silt and different substances that they've called drift. And because those are not in this particular area, they call this a driftless area. And it's characterized by very rugged hills and winding valleys and quickly rushing little streams. And it's not as suitable to farming as many of the, you know, flatter grounds with a lot of the silt in the ground that it washed in. And so it's tended to remain a rather underpopulated area, and the people that live there tend to be a little more tenaciously inclined.
I know that region just a bit. It's got a kind of primordial feel to it, with that unscraped, that craggy terrain that remains there.
Oh, exactly. I'm glad you've been there. And all these rock sidings come reaching out to the roads, and you always think, well, boy, what could be right beyond there? I mean, it's just a wonderful area.
What took you back to this part of the world, of all the regions in all the world, back in 1972? You had been raised Quaker in Iowa, had gone off to Beloit in Wisconsin for college, and then ultimately to Marlboro College in Vermont, back to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and then with no small number of new young novels under your belt, you ended up in this kind of not exactly mainstream spot on the map of Wisconsin. How and why?
Well, it was, I think, mostly just happenstance, other than that I was living in Iowa, which I I love very much because that's where I was born and raised. But I wanted desperately to live in the country, and the land in Iowa was just too expensive to conceive of buying any or having a home on any. And so I started looking around for cheaper areas where I could live, and my younger brother had once spent some time up around the Spring Green area in Wisconsin, and which is right on the Wisconsin River, and I'd enjoyed that area, so I went up there, and my wife and I found a house that we liked, and I invited my father to come up and look at it, and he came up and looked at it, and of course he didn't like it at all, and he said, "Well, we're only about 20 miles here from the place where some of your mother's ashes were spread, okay, on the cemetery up in this little town, so why don't we go up there and visit the cemetery?" So we drove up there, and at that time they had one remaining little shop in the town with a gas pump in front, and we got out, and there was a guy that came out and pumped some gas, and we asked him, "Are there any, you know, moderately priced homes for sale in this area?" And he opened the back door, got in the car, and said, "Bring me back and I'll show you four." And we ended up getting one of those.
It turned out to be not so far where a preacher grandfather of yours had lived as well. You were there, you were still in your 20s, three novels published. John Gardner, the great novelist, would call you one of the best eyes in recent fiction. You were getting pretty good reviews, and things came to a kind of screeching halt in a motorcycle accident. What happened when?
Well, that was in 1977. I had been riding motorcycles for years, and I had become rather fearful of riding them, which is odd. And I ended up trading the motorcycle that I had for a bicycle to a neighbor boy that was interested in it. And he had it for, a year or so. And then he got it running, and he brought it over and showed it to me. And I said, "Well, let me take a ride on it." And I guess that was the last ride I took. I got to going too fast around a gravel corner, and I couldn't control it. And I hit a rock. And when I flipped over, then I was paralyzed from the chest down. And that kind of issued in sort of a darker chapter of my life, I guess. And I don't know, after the recovery, if you can kind of call it that, because I was more or less in the hospital for 2 years.
In Madison, he got addicted to the painkillers there, lost the first wife.
Yeah, I did that, and my first wife, reasonably enough, decided, this is not good. We had a small child, and I think it was the right choice for her to make, but it in the same period of time, I was still trying to write, and I was still churning out manuscripts, but I was just immensely dissatisfied with them. They were really insufferable, and I was looking to find a kind of a new voice, I guess, for myself. And it just took a long time.
When did the terrain where you were sort of hunkered down, I guess you'd say, and eventually with a very important new wife, Edna, who you are wildly grateful to in your notes in this novel, but when did you begin to see the terrain around you right there through the fictional words Wisconsin as the terrain of new fiction for you?
Well, this actually was, like I said, I'd spent about 20 years writing books that I was very, very unhappy with. And then I had a friend of mine who was a farmer in the area, and he died about 12 years ago in a very tragic farming accident.
Caught in his equipment in the hydraulic or something, happens on farms.
Yes, he was caught, and he was beat to death by a machine. Mm-hmm. And I guess he was just a very good friend of mine. I thought I knew him very well. And he wasn't a very religious fellow, and his wife asked me if I would do some officiating at one of the funerals. They had two funerals, and the one that was held in my area, she wondered if I wouldn't take some part in that, and so I did. And I went to the funeral, and I looked around, and there were about 250 people there, and I knew about 30 of them. And all of them felt as deeply about my friend as I did, and I didn't know any of them. And it had dawned on me, this is curious. To really know my friend, I knew him through his relationship with me, but to really know who he was, I would have to know all these different people and know what his relationship with each one of them was, what he meant to them and what they meant to him. And then I got the idea from that perhaps our identities, who we think we are, which we usually think of as persisting from one relationship to another in a rather whole and complete form, is really not like that at all, but rather that every individual that we see and come into a relationship with has a piece of us, and that our they hold that identity with them, and that our entire ourself is a compositely put together, and all these different little pieces and all these different people that make us who we are. And so I thought that this would be a excellent way to try to write a book in which it had the feeling kind of a funeral, where there are many people there and they're all kinds of different people, and yet the link that links them all together is someone that's actually not there. And it just intrigued me to death. And I thought, well, this is worth looking into.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist David Rhodes, who published his first three novels and gained acclaim in his 20s. In the 1970s, then, was in a motorcycle accident, was paralyzed, and more or less disappeared for three decades. Now he's back with his new novel, Driftless, an extraordinary comeback set in the rural Midwest. He joins us today from Madison, Wisconsin. David Rhodes, you were just describing that kind of link that this whole Spoon River anthology style network, a web of individuals, is woven around, and at the middle of that is a character who comes out of one of your original novels, July Montgomery, from way back then. You open the novel with him out keeping an eye on his cows and a big black animal jumping the fence into his hayfield and turning to stare right at him, a very big cat, a panther or cougar. He said, once native to the area, but no reports as far as he had known for generations. And you've got us into some in a deep fog there, and you've got us into some pretty misty territory very early on. You described Faulkner as one of your great literary heroes, and you had us kind of moving in his tones, I thought, right there from the outset.
Well, thank you. No, Faulkner was always a real favorite of mine. He gripped me when I was a young man, and he just had a way of enchanting me. I would start one of his pages, and I would, he often had to have these long, luxurious sentences and paragraphs, and you'd be reading down there, and all of a sudden you'd see a word, and you'd think, wait a minute, that word's got a kind of a funny feeling. I don't know if I like that word there. And then you'd continue reading, and before long he'd use that word again, and he'd be a way of saying, I knew you'd think that word was funny, that's why I put it in there again. and I was just delighted with him. He had a way of being able to cast a spell around the community that he was in, so that the community itself seemed to almost have a voice and be part of the characters. And I really like that.
Yeah, there's another author, public radio listeners will know well, Garrison Keillor, who takes a kind of a fun approach to these towns. You bring a little more weight to it in your treatment. We should read just a little bit for us here. You've got one of your characters talking about how in words, saying the golden years of words must have been sometime after the territory joined the Union in 1848, pretty far back. But then there's a description you have here of the kind of small village you've envisioned, off sort of at the end of the road, not really on the map, and really beyond the peak of its life. You describe small villages and like words and how people imagine, picture themselves there. Could you read just a bit?
Yes, I'd be glad to. And this one goes like this. The small villages blossomed with schools, post offices, and implement dealers, grain and grain cooperatives, hardware, fabric, and grocery stores, filling stations, banks, libraries, and taverns. And the driftless farmers moved into these villages after their bodies wore out. Old men and women sat on porches in work clothes faded by the sun and softened by innumerable washings to resemble pajamas. They talked in whispers, shelling hazelnuts into wooden bowls, telling stories, endless stories, about long ago. The young people listened but were skeptical. It didn't seem possible for men and women to do the things described in those stories. People didn't act like that. They don't now, the old people complained. It was impossible to explain how in those days, in earlier times, in the past, there really were giants, people who did things, good things, odd things, that others would never do. Those giants were at the heart of everything. Nothing could have been the way it was without them. But how could anyone explain them after they were gone?
David Rhodes, reading from his new novel, Driftless, his first published in more than 3 decades after a motorcycle accident that kind of took him off the map. We're glad he's back with us now. There's a lot more we want to learn, David. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join this conversation. Let's go first to Spokane, Washington, and Bob. Bob, you're on the air with David Rhodes.
Hello, Tom, and hello, David.
Hi.
I can't wait to get the book. I've loved everything I've heard so far, and it resonated so much with me. I wanted to share that I had the same kind of epiphany that David had when I was at the funeral of my cousin Polly. I looked around the funeral area, and I realized that most of the people there I knew nothing about. And I realized that I had really missed something by not knowing more about my cousin and about the different aspects of her life.
And can you see what David Rhodes is referring to, that maybe your cousin actually lived different lives through each of those relationships or showed different facets of herself?
Well, absolutely. In fact, there was a famous movie star that was attending the funeral that I didn't know where that came from. And so it was a whole facet of Polly's life that I was really... sorry that I didn't know more about.
David, there's testimony to exactly that human dynamic. You describe at the funeral of your friend, the heart of the book.
I think it's more or less a universal experience for us when we get older. I think one of the ways to illustrate this, how this works in our life, is that think back to when you were in the first grade, maybe, and you went with your mother down to the grocery store. And you turn to an aisle in the grocery store, and all of a sudden there's your first grade teacher. And your first reaction is, get out of here. You don't belong here. You belong in the school. That's where you're supposed to be.
In that little tiny frame, that room.
Yes, in that little room. Go back there because, this is the place that I'm with my mother in the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with our parents. As we grow up with our parents, we think we know them really well, and it takes us many, many years to figure out, now, wait a minute, I always related to my dad and mom by being my parents. Who are they really?
If we're ever lucky enough to figure that out.
Exactly. So then you spend your last year trying to figure out who are they, because you've gotten so far behind because of the relationship that you thought was completely defined by its circumstances, relating to you. Mm-hmm. We all have these hidden parts that other people bring out, different parts of us, and we're not quite the same with anybody.
I want to turn to some of these characters in Driftless, but let's get one more call first. Bob in Spokane, thanks for calling. Gina in Nashville, you're on the air with David Rhodes.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I grew up in Iowa, and actually I just traveled there last week for my dad's funeral. So this idea is very much on my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I have two questions. One is, I wonder if the author is familiar with C.S. Lewis has a quote about this as well, that when one of his friends died, he lost that friend's ability to tell a joke. and to make another friend laugh. And he just thought he'd never hear his friend laugh that way again because the other friend had passed away. And then my other question is, I grew up in a Dutch town in Iowa where there was a lot of stoicism and a lot of things unsaid. And I wonder if that makes the stories more rich because so much of it happens under the surface.
Gina, thank you. David Rhodes, what about the culture you're conveying here? Stoic? Things unsaid? There's a lot said here as well, I have to say, ultimately. How would you describe it?
She's right, and that was an excellent point to make, that there is a certain amount of stoicism, and there are many taciturn individuals within this particular area. And I think what I wanted to do with the book was to concentrate on the particular types of struggles that all of them were involved in, and to try to give a as articulate of a voice as I could to their internal thoughts as they tried to think their way through these different problems that they face in the book, and in some way resolve through their relationships with each other. And so I think that that was a major part, but it was made more difficult because the area in which I live, many of the rural people just don't talk very much about what they're feeling and thinking. So one has to get sort of to know them very well to the place where then you start realizing that, I've now know them well enough, so I'm now can experience moments in where things feel to me like I think they feel to that other person. And then I think you've pretty much captured them.
I think you've done an amazing job of that. I guess I have to ask whether being slowed down by your motorcycle accident, even by your wheelchair and everything that means in life, somehow also slowed your or let you slow down to where you could observe in this kind of subtlety and detail. How did it change you as a writer, David?
Well, after the accident, I really needed to, in some way, find a new identity for myself. And I struggled long and hard with who am I now and, what can I be to other people and so forth. And I think one of the reasons that my earlier attempts at writing after the accident were unsuccessful is because I was more focused on differences. I would notice the difference between people that could walk and weren't all busted up and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And these were the kinds of things that tended to isolate me in my own mind. And it took a long time to get to the place where I could see that the kinds of problems that I faced were being faced by everybody, only in different forms. And then I started to see the similarities rather than the differences. And by doing that allowed me to crawl inside the minds of these characters that volunteered for me to write about them. I found my voice, so to say, in doing that. And in some way joined, instead of writing, endlessly rewriting my story, I was finding myself involved in trying to write our story.
Would you be kind enough to begin to introduce us to some of those characters who, as you say, volunteered to be part of this story? There's some remarkable people and stories that emerge in Driftless. Could you begin to unveil your cast of characters a bit for us?
Well, I have a young man and his wife, and they have two children, and they're farming.
Dairy farmers.
They're dairy farmers, and the young wife, they are barely getting by, mm-hmm. and the young wife realizes she needs, to get health insurance and to make some extra money. So she gets a job working for the milk cooperative that they sell their milk to, and over several years, she becomes a bookkeeper, an assistant bookkeeper. And then she realizes that the cooperative that she's working for is basically selling, in some cases, tainted milk and is cheating the dairy farmers.
So they have the dilemma of what to do about that inside, and they're not confronting it from a position of power. They began to confront and very quickly get in trouble with the powers that be.
Exactly. And they're clearly over their heads, but they really don't have anything but their own natural resources to draw on. So it's just their struggle against these overwhelming odds and what happens to them in the course of dealing with this.
He has a sister down the road, Gail Shotwell, who likes to hang out naked at her home, kind of in the woods, and sing I guess it's sort of a country or country rock band. And
Gail is in a country western band, and she works in a plastic factory. And she finds that clothes are just too inhibiting for her. So I guess you would say she's kind of a closet nude, maybe. But she feels more free. But she's also quite shy, so she tries to do this, in the privacy of her home and backyard when she practices playing her bass guitar, which she does in the band.
You've got Rusty and Winifred, the farmer and the young preacher lady.
Yes. Rusty is a 72-year-old man, or somewhere around there, and he's recently retired from his farming operation. And he's a person that has kind of walked away from his family, his original family, many, many years ago. And in the course of the book, he discovers that there's something missing in his life, and he needs to try to rediscover his sisters and brothers, if they're still living. And so he goes on kind of an adventure to see where they are, and he hasn't talked to them for 55 years. And it's the kind of an expansion of his feeling about himself, and he's finally able to have the courage to allow some of the thoughts that came from his earlier life to be a part of his present life.
You've got the cougar and the haymow and love and dogfight and epic blizzard in here and life savings lost at a casino. And then kind of bravely, these two sisters, Olivia and Violet, Olivia, who is herself wheelchair bound.
Yes. I wanted to do a study in some way to show the dynamic nature that exists between caregivers and care receivers, the close way in which they're knit together, so to say, and the kind of how every little change in either one of them will be reflected in the other. And this of course, situation between caregivers and caretakers is one that I became familiar with over the years, and it's a very precious one, and one that offered me a lot of room to discuss different ideas in.
There's something invaluable in the way you've gone on your journey and come back to us with this book. I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed it. I look forward to some more reading after we take a short break here. We've got a lot of listeners who want to speak with you as well. David Rhodes is with us. Three novels in his 20s in the 1970s, and then a motorcycle accident that took him off the grid for more than 30 years. He's back with the new novel, Driftless. It is wonderful. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist David Rhodes. Let's go to Youngstown, Ohio, and John. John, you're on the air with David Rhodes.
Hi. I'm a physician that several years, I work at a medical school, and several years ago I became ill with a bacterial infection and almost died. At the same time, the hospital I work at became financially ill and did die. And I started to jot something down about this, and friends and colleagues said, you need to write this all down immediately and capture it. And I was kind of delayed by time in writing anything down about this to put down the thoughts. And I was wondering if Dave had any take on, does the time that you take to write something give you more perspective? Is it worth the detail you lose? Or should you write this stuff down immediately and and maybe not gain the perspective the time gives you.
David Rhodes, you've had the time. How do you see it?
Well, I think if you've got something to write down that you feel an urge to do, then you should write as fast as you possibly can. And I guess that was partly what I did after I had the idea of this. But I don't think that necessarily means that you're done with it right away. In my case, I started out all these characters, but my characters just refused to cooperate with me. And they wake me up in the middle of the night and they'd say, I don't like what you got me thinking here. I don't like what you got me doing. I wouldn't do that. And I had to, it took me over 10 years to put this book together, even though I had thought I had the idea in the beginning. So I think as long as you have the urge to put something down, and it sounds like you have a very interesting story, John, that you should, you know, start getting it down right now. I mean, don't wait. And you'll have a lot of time to go over it and make it as good as you can, which I'm sure you'll want to do. But I wouldn't put it off any longer. It sounds like a wonderful story.
As the voice of experience for you, John, let's get a call from Londonderry, Vermont, and Susan. Hi, Susan. You're on the air with David Rhodes.
Yes, hello. I'm calling from a small town in rural Vermont, and I wanted to say to both of you that I was very glad to hear about this book, and to I'm just overwhelmed with delight that David would write such a book on such a topic, because my one daughter, not only did she go to Madison, Wisconsin for her college career, but over and above that, I am a registered nurse for 37 years, and I volunteer with NAMI, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. And I have a son with a disability, a mental health disability, and I myself have a severe hearing loss. And what I want to say is that I feel that David not only has the qualities of understanding, wisdom, and empathy, but he brings a sense of humor through his book, and I would absolutely delight in meeting him someday. And I know you, I heard from Tom's interview that you went to college in Marlboro, Vermont.
That's correct.
And I just wanted to tell you that I realize you probably don't want to drive this far, but you would absolutely be welcome in Vermont at any time. And this Friday, on November 7th, we are having our Vermont conference for the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. And I'm an RN 37 years, and I grew up in New York City, believe it or not, and I absolutely love living in a small town.
Susan, thank you for that. It sounds like the welcome mat is out for you, David Rhodes. Let me just ask you on that front. There was a moment that I marked in the book, you were talking about July Montgomery, the one-time drifter who's come to town and worked his way into the fabric of Words, Wisconsin. And I wondered if you were writing something about yourself in those years when you were kind of struggling back from your accident. You wrote, his life had grown too thin, and he was nearing the end of himself. He was living but didn't feel alive. Somehow, Susan makes me want to ask, you know, you had your own addiction during that period. It must have been a tremendous mental trial at points. Did you feel yourself out in that thinness, that edge?
Yes, I did. I needed desperately more connection with people. And thankfully, the wonderful thing in my life is that at every juncture where I've decided this is it, I can't go any further, somebody is there and says, oh, yes, you are. And it just, so I am so grateful for the number of people that have allowed me to overcome some of these difficulties and have given me the space to do it. And without them, I wouldn't be here. My life is simply in the hands of too many people to mention. And it just is. And part of the struggle, I think, with climbing out of the hole that I was in is developing the capacity of appreciation for these people. And
I wish you'd tell us a little of the story of how you kind of came back into this publishing world. As I read it, there was a young man, Philip Christman, out of the University of South Carolina, an MFA student there, who found one of your earlier books in a public library, fell in love with it, which is fascinating to me that such a young person in the 2000-noughts would fall in love with this from the 1970s, and then tracked you down, got Milkweed Editions, the nonprofit publisher in Minneapolis, in a friend of his there interested, and actually came down to your home in Wisconsin, sat with you, and out tumbled this manuscript. Have I got it right?
Well, pretty much, yes. I was more surprised than you can possibly imagine. These two young, bright men wanted to come visit me, and I said, "Well, sure, come on down." And they came, and I was just overwhelmed. I didn't think anybody read those old books. I think there was always some question in my mind whether an uncle in Utah had bought one of my books, and that would have made, I think, 15 that I sold. But this young fellow found one, and he took it to his friend and said, you got to find out about this guy. And they contacted my agent that I used to have, and she says, "Well, I don't know what he's doing." And so she sent me an old email I had, and that was picked up by the filter on my server, and I was looking through those. You know, you can select them all and delete them. And
right.
And my wife Edna was looking over the shoulder and said, "What's that say?" It says Rock Online there, which is the name of my third
earlier book.
And, yeah, and why don't you read that? So I read it, and that was how I got in contact. And then I sent him an email back, and he came out, and he said that he wanted to, the editor from Milkweed wanted to republish the third novel. And I said, "Well, that was from a long time ago, and I guess I'd be willing to do it if I don't have to read it, because I haven't read it all these years, and I'm afraid I'm a lot older person, and I can't read anything without trying to change it, and I don't want to make it mature. So if I just leave it alone the way it was, then that's fine." And they agreed to that, and then Ben asked me, "Well, have you got anything you're working on now?" And I said, "Well, actually, I do." And he said, "Can I take a look at it?" And anyway, and here we are.
Here we are. I was intrigued, and yet I somehow understood in reading this why such young readers would be drawn to it. There's something very, very contemporary, almost, it sounds weird, but almost hip about your style. You say, for example, in the dialogue, you're not trying to convey a rural twang. You're not trying to put it into exactly even the parlance, or certainly not the sort of John Steinbeck style recreation of rural talk. You're really conveying ideas in a way that's more flat, but incredibly powerful somehow. How do you interpret your appeal to that very young end of American reading, book buying public?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I just love talking to you, Tom, because you read books. And John Steinbeck, you mentioned, is one of my favorites. But he has a talent that I don't have, where he can refer to the colloquial language of people that aren't very educated, and he can show the depth of their thoughts with that language. But I couldn't solve that problem for me, because I wanted a lot of different kinds of characters, and I wanted them to all stand on their own, and I wanted each one of their adventures to basically be like they were a main character, and they were true to themselves, and to be just as complex as people. And then I was afraid of putting in the colloquial dialogue, because when you have an educated person that talks well, and then you have a less educated person who normally wouldn't be able to express themselves well, it implies it's a demeaning judgment.
A diminishment, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. She, and I didn't want to do that, because even though people can't express their feelings and their thoughts as well, which is a separate kind of gift. Mm-hmm. Their life is just as rich, mm-hmm. just as full of meaning, just as full of connection, just as full of the problems that everybody else faces. Mm-hmm. So I adopted a style in which I could hopefully address the inner thoughts and the inner workings of these people's lives in a way that, because of the language, didn't make you think, oh, well, this person is a lesser person. And so Amen. It was something that I struggled with very mightily to overcome that. But I wish I had John Steinbeck's talent, because, boy, that guy could do it.
Well, you've got your own, and we're glad for it. It's remarkable. Caroline's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Caroline, you're on the air with David Rhodes.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for the segment so far. I really enjoyed it. I'm excited to read the book. And I just have a question. I'm wondering, you talked a little bit, David, about the stoicism, maybe, of people in your area that you're writing about. And I realize this is a fictional novel, but I'm just wondering about the reception to the novel of people in your area, whether they're sort of greeting their stories being told with enthusiasm or even a sense of betrayal, perhaps, that they're private stories. And I'll go ahead and take the answer off air.
Thanks, Caroline. What about it, David, up in Wanawak, Wisconsin? Are they going to recognize themselves or pieces of themselves here? Do your neighbors there, over all these years, have they even known necessarily that you're a writer?
Well, many of them didn't, because it was a way of relating to people that, I guess, for many years I felt like that was part of my past and that I should develop a new sense of myself. And so I very seldom related to people through, through the personhood of being an author. And so I suppose, and I know that it surprised many people to say, oh, well, you actually write books. And yes, I do. I can say, so far the book, I'm pleased to say, has been well received. But then, of course, there's kind of a filter out there, and those that receive it well, you're likely to hear from, and those that don't, you probably won't. So I certainly hope so. I tried in every way to write about characters that I thought you could find in this particular area in some ways that would represent the many wonderful little subcultures that exist in rural areas all across the country, which are the great thing about these is that you can go in and out of them. You can enter the church culture. You can enter the culture of people that are enthusiastic about driving machines, and you can enter the group of people that love to hunt, and you can enter the group of people that do other things. And so I wanted to have a kind of a representative crew, people doing somewhat representative things of the area. And if I succeeded in some small way, I'm certainly happy about that.
Well, and it certainly gets you up and out of the house, at least in your imagination. They're dating at dogfights, and you've got your gal in the wheelchair who pretty soon is helping a guy just out of prison escape from the police. They're charging down the back roads. This is not exactly quietude that settles over the plot as it unfolds here.
No, I tried to put things in the book so that enough different kinds of things so that it could stand as a representation for the kinds of lives that we all live. I mean, we all have episodes that are dangerous and frightening, and we all have episodes of tremendous peace. And we have both the hardships and the joys, and I wanted them all in there. And so there are some kind of crazy and wild things that happen. But that seems to me the way our lives go. I mean, we just, they're unpredictable. And they'll just go in any direction at any time. And we're constantly being influenced by the people around us who, sometimes lead us astray and sometimes save our lives. So.
You were so prolific and so successful so early in the 1970s with three novels that came out one after another and coming out of the Iowa Writers Workshop and all the rest. Would that young writer recognize you now? Are you the same man, David Rhodes?
I don't think so, because the publisher agreed in republishing The Rock Island Line that that I wouldn't have to read it. But then they reneged on that, and they sent me the galleys and said I had to read it. And
go back to Rock Island Line, read it again.
Right, right. So I read it again, and I blushed all the way through it. I felt like I could kind of remember that fellow that wrote it, but I'm a lot different person now, and I have a lot different kind of writing voice. But it was just fascinating, though. It's been quite a journey.
Well, it's a remarkable story, really, from first to last. We're very glad you're back. I'm awfully happy for Philip Christman, who found your book in the library and tracked it down through Ben Barnhart and Milkweed Editions. And all that's come out, the novel is Driftless. I should say to our listeners, you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And David Rhodes, congratulations. We're very happy to have your voice back in the choir of American literary voices. And welcome back. Welcome home. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
David Rhodes, author of Driftless, joining us there from Madison, Wisconsin. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.